From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Let me thank him for what he said about my leadership, and let me say how much I enjoyed appearing on a platform with him at the final rally outside Birmingham University, which brought together himself, myself, and Gordon Brown in a unique but obviously unpersuasive trilogy.
It might have sounded like Comedy Night at the Apollo, but that was actually British Prime Minister David Cameron Monday at the first parliamentary session after last week's Brexit referendum. He was replying to a series of questions about last week's vote from Tim Farron, a member of Parliament and the head of Britain's Liberal Democratic Party. Cameron displayed a remarkable ease in the face of what he called as recently as last Wednesday a catastrophe.
In the last few years, we've seen tanks rolling into Georgia and Ukraine. And of this, I'm completely sure. The European Union has helped reconcile countries which were once at each other's throats for decades. Britain has a fundamental national interest in maintaining common purpose in Europe to avoid future conflict between European countries. The overwhelming weight of independent opinion, from the International Monetary Fund to the OECD, from the London School of Economics to the Institute of Fiscal Studies, also supports the fact that Britain will suffer an immediate economic shock and then be permanently poorer for the long term. The evidence is clear. We'll be better off in and poorer if we leave.
That was Prime Minister Cameron, May 9th of this year. Although Labour's leader, Jeremy Corbyn, was also a supporter of the so-called Remain vote that would have turned down Brexit, he pointed to the very real sentiments among workers in the UK.
Many people feel disenfranchised and powerless, especially in parts of the country that have been left behind for far too long. Communities, Mr. Speaker, that have been let down, not by the European Union, but by Tory governments. Those communities don't trust politicians to deliver because for too long they haven't.
Here in the U.S., the findings of the Congressional Committee that conducted the so-called Benghazi hearings were released Tuesday. The committee's been investigating former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's conduct before and after the killing of the U.S. ambassador and three colleagues in Benghazi in 2012. According to the New York Times, the report found no new evidence of wrongdoing by Clinton, but the committee's website at benghazi.house.gov/newinfo states that among the new evidence was proof that the Libyan forces that evacuated the Americans from the CIA annex to the Benghazi airport was not affiliated with any of the militias that either the CIA or the State Department had relationships with over the prior 18 months of the war there. Instead, that group was comprised of former Gaddafi government loyalists whom the U.S. had helped remove from power in 2011. For her part, Hillary Clinton tried to downplay the significance of the report, instead attempting to address the vast trust deficit she faces among voters, according to polls.
A lot of people tell pollsters they don't trust me. Now, I don't like hearing that. And I've thought a lot about what's behind it. And, you know, you hear 25 years worth of wild accusations, anyone would start to wonder. So, yes, I could say that the reason I sometimes sound careful with my words is not that I'm hiding something, it's just that I'm careful with my words. I believe what you say actually matters. I think that's true in life, and it's especially true if you're president.
But the emphasis on language, rather than distracting from her involvement in Libya, was likely to raise more questions about her use of language in perhaps her most famous statement on the subject of Libya.
As we came, we saw, he died.
Clinton was joined on the podium Monday by Senator Elizabeth Warren, who attacked Republican presumptive nominee Donald Trump.
What kind of a man roots for people to lose their jobs, to lose their homes, to lose their life savings? I'll tell you what kind of a man. A small, insecure money grubber who fights for no one but himself.
For more on all of that, we spoke with our regular contributor and political analyst, Professor Anthony Montero, from Philadelphia via Skype. Tuesday. Tony, welcome back.
How you doing, Don? Good to be back.
It's been a very eventful week since we last spoke.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. The earth has been shaken. The working class people who were the support for the Brexit in the main, in terms of actual feet that went to the polls, they've spoken, and they want something different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes. And it seems that what they have done is resonating throughout the Euro-American world, that is the main centers of global capitalism, because people are now talking about a Frexit, that is France exiting and the Netherlands exiting. And of course, Spain and Portugal and Greece have been on the edge of exiting or rearranging their relationship to the European Union institutions in Brussels for some time. Now, of course, there is a big split, a larger split in the European Union because Germany wants to hold it together for obvious reasons, because countries like Greece owe them money, and they're going to get their money one way or another. So they want to hold the European Union together. I think this is the greatest crisis that capitalism as a system has faced in 70 years, and maybe longer, because this is not just an economic crisis. This is a crisis of those who control power in the capitalist world. And what the English people said, in particular the English working class said, is that we reject the authority, the legitimacy, the policies, and so on and so forth, of the ruling elite. This is huge.
You know, was it interesting, looking at all the reactions everywhere, and also all of the actions that were taken leading up to try to influence the vote, President Obama going over there and almost instructing the working class in the UK how to vote. And you had, you know, which of course probably provoked some people to come out and vote against it, saying, what's this Yank doing in our business? The entire British political elite, in essence, with the exception of those who became a part of that elite or the opposition within it on issues like this, for example, Farage. But you had Corbyn and Cameron on the same side. It's analogous to what you're seeing shaping up around Hillary Clinton right now in the United States. You have the neoliberals and the neoconservatives lining up behind Clinton and or facilitating an attack on Trump by lifting up the Libertarian Party in the case of the Koch brothers.
In fact, I think that push towards the unity of the elites and the main financial centers of American capitalism and really global capitalism, that push has intensified since Brexit, and they're going to act increasingly in ways that suggest that they are in a state of panic, and they do see the possibility of losing it all. Now, of course, we're on the doorstep of another recession. And probably Brexit just sped it up a few months. And so we're going to have an election this year in the United States in the throes of both a recession and maybe another great recession or epic recession and a political crisis where the masses, the majority of people have said that all of the institutions of neoliberal control and rule are no longer legitimate. They no longer accept the ruling class politicians as honest, as legitimate, as acting in the interest of the people. And if I might just say one other thing, and I don't know if this is being fully understood, the thing of taking our country back is not insignificant, because that literally is an anti-financial, capitalist, corporate slogan. Because under the rules of the World Trade Organization and these other trade agreements, and certainly the European Union, corporations trump state power. And therefore, citizenship, for example, in England, in France, in other countries, has been diminished as corporate power is able to trump governmental and state power in various countries. So the whole slogan of taking our country back is another way of even talking about taking our citizenship back and rejecting this overarching dictatorial power of the transnational corporations and banks, and in the case of England, what they call the city, which is the same as our Wall Street.
Only bigger. Yeah.
Only bigger, yeah.
I mean, what they're talking about in essence, and it's interesting to keep in mind that there's this sense and a reality of a loss of power, a loss of control mm-hmm. over their lives, a diminished standard of living as a consequence of that,
yeah,
and
yeah.
And the sense that these really the area, the arena in which this takes place is over economics. And so mm-hmm. when people basically have had their livelihoods taken away from them and their ability to advance taken away from them, when they're saying, let's take our country back, they're talking about seizing control of the economy from the elites.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think Cameron, I think you played the clip of Cameron talking mm-hmm. about if Britain leaves the European Union, what we could look forward to, what the British people could look forward to, was war, genocide, and poverty. Well, what was the situation before the British people voted against the EU?
Yeah.
War, genocide, and poverty.
Right.
I mean, I don't know where this guy is living. But you know something, Don? When you look at these wars in the Middle East, Iraq, Libya, now Syria, to a certain extent, Afghanistan, what, and this might be an unintended consequence, but I'm not so certain of that.
And let's not leave out wars across Africa.
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. Civil wars and economic impoverishment. Yes, absolutely. But what these wars have created is a nomadic precariat. That is, they have forced the working classes and middle classes and populations in general in places like Iraq and Syria, where people had a stable and decent life, Syria, the same thing. Suddenly, these people are refugees, which in effect are a nomadic precariat who constitute millions and tens of millions of people who are cheap labor without any political or legal rights. It is as close to modern-day slavery as it gets. So these wars serve the interest of the capitalists, who are always interested in lowering the cost of labor, and thus become, because of their desperation due to war and genocide, become a way for the capitalists to attack the working classes of these various countries. In the case of England and Great Britain, most of the new refugees, precariat, that is precarious labor, come from Eastern Europe, countries which were destroyed as a result of the collapse of socialism and these austerity policies that the European Union and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund imposed upon them. I mean, this. I think there's a way to look at all of this so-called war and genocide as part and parcel of the neoliberal, neoconservative policy of attacking the cost of labor and the standard of living of the working classes in Europe and America.
And, you know, it's also like a self-reifying mechanism because in the context of racism or anti-immigrant sentiment or nationalism or whatever, you know, you are exciting those things, stimulating them. You know, it's one thing if five refugees come into your country over the course of a year and people are prejudiced. It's another thing when masses of people are driven out of their homes and come through. Absolutely. And there's a collapse of the labor market. It's very easy to scapegoat the people who were the biggest victims themselves.
Absolutely. And so the elites in Europe and the United States play both sides of the game. You know, NAFTA, among other things, destroyed the Mexican peasantry.
Yep.
And force them from their country, which they didn't want to leave, to come north to seek a way to survive. And many of them don't intend to stay here, although many do end up staying here much, much longer than they ever intended. But the wars in Central America, El Salvador in particular, the war against Nicaragua, plus NAFTA, so undermined social and economic life in Mexico and Central America that it forced people to come north. And they come north without legal rights and as cheap, close to slave labor. And that's what we're looking at.
And it happens during a time of contracting wages across the board, shrinking job opportunities, an economy that doesn't need workers as much.
That's right. And you know, you get a place like Mexico, the cynicism of the ruling class of Mexico to say to the peasants, you know, a way of to go north. It's their way of exporting the class conflict out of their country into the United States.
While it's sicking one segment of the working class against another.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And so we're back to the old proposition of internationalism, that workers have to unite, that workers, and that's why even with the Brexit, and even though workers are voting for Brexit, and even though in the United States, in increasing numbers of impoverished workers are gravitating towards Trump, the fact of the matter is workers need their own positions on all of these things, which means that, as in the case of England and Brexit, and in the case of the United States, the trade union misleadership sides with the alleged liberal side of the corporate duopoly. Here, the AFL-CIO, the UAW, Automobile Workers Union, probably the Steel Workers Union, all have been devastated by NAFTA and these trade deals and the neoliberal austerity policies, but yet they side with Clinton. The same thing in England. They sided with Cameron and Corbett and so on and so forth. But the working class voted against it. And we're seeing the same thing in this country. Now, this is spontaneous. It is not yet fully ideologically and politically developed, but it represents the initial foray, the initial shot across the bow, that the working class and class questions are on the agenda, and we're not going away. You can call us dumb. You can call us racist. You can call us whatever you want. You can try to shame us. But the fact of the matter is, the working class is now standing up and beginning to learn how to talk and speak for itself. Now, it might use vehicles that are not comfortable for those of us who are traditionally on the left. But what we have to do is we have to see what's below the surface. And I think going forward, the situation looks far more positive than it has looked in 70 years in terms of the working class. The whole architecture of neoliberal rule, neoliberal globalist rule, is coming under attack. And I would argue the ruling elite faces an existential crisis. They don't know what to do in the face of an uprising and insurgency of the working class.
Looking at the present condition as you describe it, what's notably absent is leadership from the left. It seems like they think that somebody's going to fly a flag or a banner with a bunch of slogans. These assembled workers across town are going to see it and come flocking to them.
No.
And the people that are workers generally notice when they're working on the line or in a field or wherever, who's standing next to them when the work's being done. And the people that are standing next to them while this work is being done are on the right. How exactly does the left think it's going to co-opt the leadership of that movement once it goes in gear? Or are they guaranteeing fascism?
Well, I think the question is, what is the right? Now, clearly, from within here in the United States, from within the Republican Party, you get this rogue capitalist, Donald Trump, who does not mouth the script of the right, of the conservatives, of the neoconservatives, and therefore they're abandoning him. As you said, the Koch brothers are going to support the Libertarian Party, which is part of the Stop Trump movement. Robert Kagan, the neocon that advised all the Republican presidents over the last 20 or so years, he is now supporting Hillary Clinton. George Will, the conservative columnist talking head, he has given up his Republican registration, and now he's non-partisan, registered independent. They're uniting around the Stop Trump movement, but what they want to stop is not a conservative, or not even Trump, but this working class uprising. And they are angry at Trump because he is giving voice imperfectly and in a contradictory way, but he is giving voice to working class sentiments about their impoverishment, about the loss of jobs, about the destruction of the infrastructure, about putting war and austerity ahead of the well-being of the people of the United States. I mean, I think it's a winning position, but the left has to grow up. The left has to understand that there's more to being on the left than protests and marches. Left means influencing the working class and those allied to it. It means getting in the trenches and helping working people to solve and understand the political questions that they're confronted with. It doesn't mean protesting and marching against working people and attempting to shame them as though you are so much better than them. We have to get down deep into the working class. We have to find a way going forward to unite the Trump movement with the most advanced forces of the Bernie Sanders movement. The slogan has to be not stop Trump, but stop Clinton.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the position that Trump finds himself in with most of his class arrayed against him. Cameron, the same thing. You know, they're mad at Trump because he's giving voice to this movement. Mm-hmm. And Cameron gave it a vote. And 2 seconds after it came in, he said, oh, yeah, okay, I got to quit.
I messed up.
Yeah, so, you know, what do you think? I mean, if you're Trump, feeling the pressure of CNN 24/7 dogging you, the New York Times, ditto, all kinds of people from left to Republican right arrayed against you, the entire political establishment arrayed against you, people like Elizabeth Warren going back to the Marco Rubio size references and stuff. How do you we've seen a change in his campaign in the last week, certainly. Mm-hmm. Much more based on bread and butter issues that I guess they're seeing those issues poll well, and refraining from a lot of the wacky stuff that he was doing earlier in the primary. What's happening?
Well, first of all, it's not rocket science to understand that what is keeping Trump in this thing is the working class. You know, now all of these kind of disaffected Republican elites who are trying to move to Trump and influence him could be like Trojan horses, you know. I think that Trump and the people closest to him have to keep their ear to the ground. And I think they are, you know, his going today to Ohio and Pennsylvania, where he's very, very strong. You know, Ohio is a swing state. Yep. Pennsylvania is normally a Democratic state. But he's doing very well there, especially in western Pennsylvania, in places like Pittsburgh and its surroundings, and Aliquippa, the former steel areas. Yep. The same thing in Ohio. So he is running a campaign directed at the working class in states where the working class has been most affected by these neoliberal trade deals. And that is Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Missouri, Illinois, and New Jersey, et cetera, et cetera. So you see the point. So I think in spite of the attempt to make him look like an idiot, I think they have a strategic approach which could win this thing. In the same way, interestingly, that Brexit did not focus upon London, but focus upon those parts of England that had been deindustrialized and impoverished by the neoliberal and European Union policy.
That's right.
So Trump and what we have traditionally referred to as the right, and I'm not quite convinced that we can define it as that any longer. There's something else going. Something, in other words, it is morphing, and Trump is a part of this. It is morphing under the weight of the working class. Trump does not stand a snowball's chance in hell if he goes the traditional Republican electoral route. His only hope is to keep the insurgency going, keep the attacks upon the elites going, and get closer and closer to the working class, including the African-American and Mexican-American Latino working people. And he can do far better among them if he sticks to class issues than people are giving him credit for.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.